This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There was a shooting in the Newcastle County Court of Common Pleas this morning in Wilmington, Delaware. According to the latest reports, a number of people have been injured and the alleged shooter is dead. This is just the latest news about the problem of gun violence in this country. And as it turns out, Vice President Joe Biden is in Philadelphia today for a roundtable discussion with law enforcement officials on gun violence. Biden has been leading the White House efforts to reduce the number of gun-related crimes, calling for universal background checks for all gun buyers, a proposed ban on assault weapons, a limit on high-capacity magazines, and a crackdown on gun trafficking. The massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, has shocked the country, and there appears to be popular support for more gun control. But the administration faces some resistance from the NRA and from some members of Congress. So today in Radio Times, is there common ground that respects the rights of gun-abiding, or I should say law-abiding gun owners, and can reduce the numbers of gun-related crimes, accidents, and suicides? We have two guests who have joined us today in Radio Times. Richard Feldman is the president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. And Richard Feldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We will try to reconnect with Richard Feldman. Hopefully we have Robert Spitzer with us.
Hello.
Hi, is this you, Richard Feldman?
Yes.
Excellent. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Robert Spitzer. He's a professor of political science, chairman of the Department of Political Science at the State University of New York in Cortland, author of The Politics of Gun Control. Robert Spitzer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yes, good to be with you today.
Nice to have you with us. Robert, if I can begin with you, and I began with a description of what appears to be a shootout in Wilmington, Delaware. Are you in any way optimistic that we can reduce gun violence in this country?
Well, yes. The issue of gun violence is large and complex. There's a lot of violence in the country. There are many guns in the country. So the general notion is to look at the intersection between those things. Most crime does not involve guns. Most guns are not involved in crimes. And there are many causes for crime, but it is certainly the case that violence and mayhem is magnified when guns are involved. And that leads directly to the question of what guns are in circulation, how did they get there, how many guns are there, what types of guns are used in crime, how are they checked? What about trafficking and the other issues that are raised by President Obama's proposals? So there's certainly a lot that the government can do, and more that it can do to get a better handle on gun violence in America.
Let me go to you, Richard Feldman. Do you see some growing consensus or agreement on steps that can be taken to address some of the problems related to gun violence and gun crimes?
Actually, I do. As this country finally begins to mature on this issue and we zero in on the problem of criminals with guns, deranged individuals with guns, and we focus our efforts on that intersection, as Professor Spitzer called it, yes, we can do something about the problem. Generally in this country, we talk about guns as though having an impact on of guns owned by the 110 million people who don't misuse them will have some salubrious impact on that very intersection of the people who don't care about the laws and are always or frequently misusing them. That's a losing effort. But if we are narrow in our focus and zero in on the problem, yes, I believe we can do something.
So the idea that the people who are law-abiding and they own guns and they take care of their guns, they are responsible gun owners, that those people can, in a sense, be protected while we address some of the problems of gun-related crimes?
Oh, well,
that's to you, Richard Feldman, and then to you, Robert Spitzer. Go ahead, Richard.
If we zero in on our... See, I'm one of those people, even though I used to represent the National Rifle Association and the firearms industry, I've never been one who point blank says, I oppose gun laws. The question is it a gun law that focuses on the problem, or is it a gun law that just focuses willy-nilly out there on guns? That will have no impact. Focusing on the problem has the possibility, at least, of having an impact. If it's rationally related to the problem, let's talk about it. If it's not even related to the problem, like so much of the legislation being proposed these days, assault weapons, banning bayonet lug nuts. Yes, I suppose if we ban bayonet lug nuts, the number of drive-by bayonettings in the city of Philadelphia might drop from zero to zero. Obviously, that's not the problem. The problem is a criminal in possession of any gun. If we zero in on that problem, we may be able to do something about it.
Well, Robert Spitzer, let me go back to you. And one of the issues that the president has called for is a universal background check. Do you think that would address the problem, or at least begin to address the problem of gun violence and gun-related crimes?
Well, sure it would, because we know that there are numerous problems with the existing background check system. There is a statistic that's often repeated. It's a bit of a mushy statistics, but between 30 and 40% of gun sales, as best we can determine, occur without background checks in America. We know there's certainly a great many. That by itself indicates that a great deal more can and certainly should be done to make uniform or universal the background check process. And it's part of the notion of the government playing its role to keep guns out of the hands of those who should not have them. Obviously, those with criminal records, those with mental disability problems. That second category has started to get more attention in recent weeks and months, which is certainly a good thing, given the fact that so many of, particularly these terrible mass shootings, have been committed by people who clearly had mental problems, well known to family and friends. They're people who gave off kind of signals to many that they were going to engage in the behavior that they indeed engaged in. And in these sorts of instances, much of that data about people with mental disabilities is simply not reported. Even today, a study reported in the newspaper a couple of weeks ago said that of the 50 states, 30 of the states even today do not provide any background information aside from those with criminal backgrounds, that is, not including those with mental problems. And that's a gaping hole that could readily and should readily be filled by bucking up the background check process and system.
And I do want to get back to that. Let me put the same question to you, Richard Feldman, and I'm curious about you and your organization, where you stand on universal background checks.
Well, the Independent Firearm Owners Association enthusiastically supports mandatory background checks at gun shows. Gun shows in most states, Pennsylvania being one, you don't need to ask very many questions, if any, and you're really in the position that a licensed dealer is in. You're open for sale to the public. So you don't know who you're selling the gun to. I think that is a part of the problem. ATF estimates that at gun shows, if background checks were accomplished on all sales, it would cut down on approximately 1% of the sales at those shows would be stopped. That's useful. That's helpful. We support it. But we're not even talking about the big part of the problem. And if we accomplished it, what would be the impact on crime? Zero. Mm. Nada. That's not where criminals, by and large, obtain firearms. There are 500,000 stolen guns in this country every year. And until we begin to zero in on the problem, we're not going to solve the problem when we don't even talk about the problem.
Well, let me pick up on that. Are you saying then if someone loses or one of their guns is stolen, they should then report that to their local police department?
Well, many people do.
For yes,
example,
I know.
If I have a list of all the serial numbers of the guns I have. If they were stolen, I'd report them to my insurance company and to my local police. A lot of good that would do if the thief took those guns several states away, walked into a pawn shop or a gun shop, and tried to sell those guns to the dealer. The dealer has no idea. He has no access to that information. This is a relatively simple fix, but we don't even talk about that. The dealer would not know that those are stolen guns. Law enforcement would know, but the dealer's not running that check. Well, we can make that information available to licensed dealers, which makes the subsequent sale back into the legitimate industry marketplace of those guns less valuable.
Well, let me pick up on that, because Robert Spitzer in Pennsylvania, there was an effort a couple of years ago to enforce or have a law that basically said if your gun was lost or stolen, you needed to report it, and it didn't make it through the Pennsylvania legislature. I'd be curious about where you stand on this.
Well, interestingly enough, New York State has recently enacted a law that now says you are required to report a stolen gun to authorities within 24 hours. So that's now on the books here in New York State. I would make a larger point about what Richard Feldman was talking about. He was mentioning the fact that guns are stolen. That is certainly the case, but most crime guns are not stolen. Most guns used in crime are not directly stolen. Certainly some are, but a great many of them, and here again, our data is kind of mushy, and this is one area where we need more research and more funding on research and better data analysis, but we know that guns used in crime come also from straw purchasers. They come from a small number of gun dealers. There was a study done in the late 1990s which found that 2% of gun dealers were responsible for 40% of guns used in crimes in selected areas. Guns come from friends and relatives. They also come from the secondary market, which is a broad reference to gun exchanges that do not include background checks. So it takes us back to the larger issue of guns coming from many diffuse sources. It's not simply a matter of guns being stolen.
Well, and just picking up on that point, Robert Spitzer, it's certainly here in Philadelphia. This, I think, is true for other cities, probably Chicago as well. And we just had the police commissioner on our show last week, and he said the problem in Philadelphia is people buying illegal handguns and using them in a commission of crimes. Do you think, and which is very different from what, you know, the sad and horrible massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. Robert Spitzer?
Yeah, they're rather different types of crimes, and it's important. Certainly, it's legitimate to focus attention on these mass shootings. It is also important to note that they are relatively rare events. Still, they're terrible events. They're events that tend to involve people who are often mentally unbalanced, and by the way, who often do use assault-style weapons. That is a weapon of choice for mass shooters. But in terms of overall crime rates, the Northeast in particular, New York State is a good example of this. New York State police report that between 80 and 90% of guns used in crimes in New York State come from out of state. And in fact, by and large, they tend to come from southern states, and the police have a term for this. They call it the iron pipeline, where there is trafficking of guns that are obtained relatively easily in states that have relatively lax laws, and trafficked up to places like New York and Chicago and other places. And that is a major concern, and of course, most of those guns and guns used in crimes are handguns, not long guns.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about, is there middle ground on this issue of gun control, gun regulation, gun violence? Robert Spitzer, professor of political science, chair of the department at State University of New York in Cortland, author of The Politics of Gun Control. Richard Feldman, president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, premiered in Paris a century ago. This centennial is a collaboration with dancers, images projected above the orchestra, and dramatic lighting. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online February 21st, 23rd, and 24th at the Kimmel Center, The Rite of Spring Centennial with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been raising money during the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we still have some work to do. Our thanks to everyone who made a pledge, but if you didn't, there's still time to do it. We rely on listeners just like you to fund the programs that you enjoy and turn to stay informed. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, and so will we. Thanks very much.
You've tried everything to get your sweetheart to stay. Flowers, candy, apologies. Now it's time to bring out the big guns. The song that pleads, I want you back.
As Valentine's Day approaches, we run down rock and roll's best pleading songs. That's this week on Sound Opinions.
I want you back. Oh,
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowain. In this hour of the show, we're examining the issue of gun control, gun politics. Is there room for compromise? Has anything changed since the Newtown shootings? And what can be done about urban violence and urban shootings? And what's behind America's very strong feelings about firearms? We're talking with Richard Feldman. He's the president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. Robert Spitzer wrote a book called The Politics of Gun Control. He's chair of the Department of Political Science at the State University of New York at Cortland, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Richard Feldman, how is your organization different from the NRA? And I know that you parted ways with the NRA a number of years back. We don't seem to have Richard Feldman. Let's see if we can get him on a better phone line. Robert Spitzer, you're a member of the NRA. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And can I ask you why?
Well, for two reasons. It allows me to kind of keep track of the information that the organization distributes. I should add also, I'm also a member of the Brady Coalition, which is the nation's largest pro-gun control group. And it's also a way for me to gather information from that organization. So it helps me stay on top of the issue from those perspectives. And it also confuses my students. So that in and of itself is a compelling reason to be a member.
That's worth the price of admission. But obviously you're a member of the NRA as an observer of the NRA. But what do you make of Wayne LaPierre, the things that he said in the last, let's say, couple of weeks since the shooting of shootings in Newtown? Has he done his cause any favors?
Well, I must tell you that I think Wayne LaPierre's representation of his organization has been terrible, frankly. He certainly has reflected the attitudes of the organization, but the manner in which he has done that, I thought, was unnecessarily ham-handed, defensive, sort of, why are you picking on us? And I think LaPierre and his associates at the NRA could have frankly done a much, much better job of presenting themselves to the American public without backtracking on their issue positions. I mean, I certainly would not expect Mr. LaPierre to come out and suddenly embrace a whole array of gun measures. Mm. Although, obviously, as Richard Feldman makes a pretty good argument for supporting some gun measures, even from somebody kind of from that perspective. But their attitude was so angry, so defensive, and really, in fact, in his speech given a week after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, here was an opportunity with the country really watching this group and its spokesman, for him to offer, you know, the words of representing gun owners who obviously do not share in, any sympathy for the kind of mass shooting and mayhem that had shocked the country at Sandy Hook, and to speak from the perspective of gun owners. Look, gun owners can do things responsibly and care about their guns and understand that a weapon is a very powerful thing to own and you have to take care with it. Instead, he was angry, he was defensive, and he talked about putting a security guard in every school in America, and I just thought it was a completely missed opportunity, and I don't think he persuaded anybody who wasn't already in his camp.
Well, Richard Feldman, hopefully we have you back on the line, and my question to you was how your organization, the Independent Firearms Owners Association, is different from the NRA, and I know you had a falling out with the NRA.
Yes, a little bit. When I ran the Firearm Industries Trade Association, I negotiated the child safety lock arrangement with Bill Clinton. It didn't make me particularly popular over at NRA, but I think as a country, we're long past the time where we really have to grow up and have the adults at the table and stop the silliness about who the messenger is. It really makes no difference to me whether a position is supported by President Barack Obama, by Professor Spitzer, or by Wayne LaPierre. If it makes sense, it makes sense on its own merits, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. And it's really the policy that we need to focus on. And, you know, I sometimes get a little upset, too. I got a little upset at your mayor in Philadelphia.
Michael Nutter.
Yes, I think he came up with a really silly off-base proposal of having the banks must divest themselves of supporting gun companies. You know, that's just such silliness and takes people's focus away from the problem when you, after all, the Philadelphia Police Department carry firearms manufactured by the very companies that the mayor would like to hold up as doing something wrong. The problem is never, never the gun per se, and is always in whose hands are the guns. And when we craft the question correctly, as I said in my meeting a month ago with Vice President Biden and Attorney General Holder, if we craft the question correctly, we're off and running on the right direction, and all Americans are in agreement in keeping guns out of the wrong hands.
Well, let me, I appreciate that, and let me just pick up on that. Does your organization then support the idea of if you purchase a gun, you should get some kind of training, sort of like driver's ed? You know, you can't drive a car unless you've actually gotten a license to do that.
Well, that's not true. You can drive a car and be 8 years old perfectly lawfully on your own property with no insurance, no registration, and no licensing. We require those things when you have that vehicle
right
on the public streets. And yes, when you carry a firearm in public, we support training on both the use of the firearm and something that only one state currently actually requires, and that's Texas, some training in the law of the use of deadly force.
Does that make sense to you, Robert Spitzer? And then we'll get some callers in.
Well, let me note that an 8-year-old cannot own an automobile. You could be completely ridiculous and put an 8-year-old behind the wheel of a car, but that would call into question your judgment. And I think that gets back to the larger question. Guns are a problem. Richard Feldman says the problem is not the gun, but that's not exactly right. I mean, a gun is a uniquely destructive and dangerous thing, and anybody who owns a gun who does not understand that probably ought not to own a gun. And there are also different kinds and degrees of gun mayhem. So take, for example, the Aurora, Colorado shooting from
right
this past July.
Right.
The gentleman who shot up the movie theater using an assault-style weapon with a 100-bullet drum magazine, plus he had some semi-automatic handguns. Had he had in his possession instead a bolt-action rifle and a 6-shot revolver, he could not have fired so many bullets so rapidly without reloading. He could still have hurt and killed people with the latter two weapons I mentioned, but the degree of destructive capability of the weapon matters, and it matters a lot, and we can't pretend that it does not.
But does that raise questions about whether there's certain guns should be banned, or certain types of guns should be banned, or that we should limit these high-capacity magazines, Robert Spitzer?
Well, it does take you to that very question, and there is, of course, this debate about regulating or restricting assault weapons or reintroducing the assault weapons ban, and part of the argument goes to the question of relative destructive capability. It's a clearer argument for the high-capacity magazines, I think, but the assault weapons argument is an argument that it is in society's interest to put kind of a cap or a limit on the kinds of weapons that American civilians should be able to own.
Let me throw that at you, Richard Feldman, for your response, and then I do when I get to our callers. I mean, you can't have a machine gun in this country. We decided.
And as Robert Spitzer knows perfectly well, a machine gun is an assault weapon, and the guns that we're talking about are not machine guns. They're semi-automatic firearms commonly owned by the American people. There are in excess of 30, 35 million of the guns that are being talked about to be banned by Dianne Feinstein's legislation. I'm unaware of any development at the National Security Agency that can attach to a drone a super magnet and suck all those guns or the magazines out of the households of the 110 million Americans who own firearms. And this is part of the problem. Once we get into this silly business of talking about good guns and bad guns, we miss the opportunity to zero in on the problem. As ATF senior leadership has said to me for the last 20 years, the gun of choice of America's criminals is the first gun they can get their hands on. And when we focus on the problem, you have gun owners and non-gun owners alike in agreement. But if we start saying, well, you know, there are kosher hot dogs and there are kosher-style hot dogs. Are they really kosher? Maybe they should be banned. Once we have that kind of a food fight, nothing serious will be accomplished. Why can't we as a people put our disagreements, which are minor, frankly, in relation to our agreements, aside and move forward on the issues we all agree on?
Well, does that make sense to you, Robert Spitzer?
Well, not quite. I mean, to say there are good guns and bad guns is nonsensical. I mean, all guns are, by their nature, destructive. There are more destructive and less destructive guns. And indeed, the government did successfully regulate fully automatic weapons in a law passed way back in 1934. That law has been extremely successful, by and large, in keeping fully automatic weapons out of the hands of most in the country, including criminals. I would also add that criminals do not simply grab the first gun that's most easily available. Even though there are twice as many long guns in America as handguns, and long guns are easier to get in many places, not in all places, 80% of all gun crimes are committed with handguns. Mm-hmm. Handguns are clearly the category of gun of preference or choice for criminals. So there are sort of weapons preferences among those who do commit crimes with guns.
And that's Robert Spitzer, again, chair of the Department of Political Science, where he's a professor at the State University of New York in Cortland, New York, author of The Politics of Gun Control. Richard Feldman with us as well, president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And we are talking today on Radio Times about finding middle ground when it comes to gun ownership and gun regulation, gun control, gun safety. Let's see what Andy from Maple Glen has to say. And Andy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Quite frankly, I'm just so angry with the kinds of sort of tropes that are thrown out to discuss this. First of all, there's a kind of a notion that if we just keep guns away from the criminals or the mentally ill, as though that's a discrete category of people is an absurd notion. If you're going through a divorce, if you're going through financial stresses, if you are mental, you know, if you are developing mental illness but don't have a record of it, there are all kinds of things that provoke people who are otherwise normal people, quote, normal people, to engage in violence. And the notion that we can just sort of categorize these people and keep guns away from them is a false notion as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Andy, let me just ask you a question because I do want to hear from our guests. So if not that, what are you suggesting?
Well, I would just, I personally feel that mandatory background checks, of course. I feel that to have allow people in this country to have military-style weapons and to have the country as awash as it is, and I will actually agree with one of the people. I really do think it's almost it really is too late, but I think that the incredible death toll in this country, which is a national disgrace, really the only thing that separates us from other countries like Britain and Italy and Japan and other places that watch our movies, that play video games, that have mentally ill people in them, is the fact that our country is awash in guns.
Well,
and the death toll that runs in the tens of thousands when these other countries have tiny handfuls of people that get killed.
Well,
let
me pick up your point because I think it's an interesting one, and I'm going to toss that first to you, Richard Feldman. Your response to Andy from Maple Glen.
Well, I do agree with Andy that. Certainly, there's too much violence, but and that it's really too late when we talk about high-capacity magazines or these type of guns. I believe I heard Robert Spitzer talking about 80%. The number I've always heard from law enforcement is 99% of crime in this country is committed with handguns. 1% is committed with long guns. That's mostly the concealability factor. Mm-hmm. people rarely are walking down the streets of Philadelphia with a long gun intending to rob anyone. Nevertheless, going back to Andy's point here, he brings up some very important and valid issues. How can you tell in advance that someone is troubled unless they've actually been into the system before? And I think that it's a very valid point, and it brings up really one of the basic issues within this whole ambit of issues, which is ultimately, whichever way we go, we're going to make mistakes. Should we err on the side of the government or err on the side of the people? And I always lean towards erring on the side of the people, knowing full well we'll make mistakes, but they'll be individual mistakes. When we err on the side of the government and there's a big mistake, it's a horrible mistake.
Well, Andy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Robert Spitzer, if you want to respond to Andy's comments or what Richard Feldman just said, go ahead. The ball's in your court.
Sure. I would just make a couple of points. Andy makes an extremely important point about mental illness. Mm. I mean, the umbrella of what comes of behavior that comes under the category of mental illness is enormous and diverse.
Yes.
And obviously, the concern is with the subcategory of people within the realm of those who have mental problems who the standard that is used is that there are people who have been adjudged mentally defective and therefore shouldn't have access to guns, and that's a small percentage of those with the full range of anything that might be considered to be mental illness. And it is a significant problem and issue to grapple with in terms of how to reconcile that category with the realm of gun ownership. It's extremely complicated, and much, much more needs to be done there. I would just add, in terms of Richard Feldman's comment, the 80% of handguns used in crime is a pretty stable number, and that's generally what's been reported, and it's gone back many decades. It can't be as high as 99%. The actual, I mean, it's a lot, obviously, right? 80% versus higher. The point is, most gun crimes are committed with handguns.
Well, and about a minute before our break here, to you, Robert Spitzer, and the little that we know about the shooter in Newtown, which is that he seemed to have some problems, but he had access to his mother's guns that were bought legally.
That is true, but the guns were in the household where he lives, and there actually is precedent at the federal level. There's a law that says if you're under a domestic order of a domestic restraining order, a domestic violence situation, the guns can be removed from the house, from the household, and that principle could readily have been applied to a circumstance where if the Newtown shooter, of course, who's now dead, but
right,
if he had been somebody who had been a judge mentally incompetent, there would have been certainly good reason to have those guns taken out of the household where he lived, even though they actually technically belonged to his mother.
But it seems to me she had a responsibility in this case as well.
Well, sure she did. And this also goes to another aspect of this where responsible gun owners have gun locks or the imposition of new technologies, something called biometrics, that would make it difficult to impossible for the people who don't actually own the guns to fire the guns. And that's someplace where the gun industry really needs to pick up the ball and enter the 21st century and get onto these new technologies.
And that's Robert Spitzer. I'm going to put that question to Richard Feldman after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
There's plenty of death, corruption, and decay in Detroit, as well as hope and inspiration. And no one tells Detroit stories quite like journalist Charlie LaDuff. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about his hometown.
We're alive here, people. Everybody in Detroit is going to be fine. Still a city.
LaDuff's new book is Detroit, An American Autopsy. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When we're afraid or overwhelmed, it's easy to look outside ourselves for comfort. In her new book, True Refuge, psychologist Tara Brach explores pathways that carry us to an inner sanctuary that's always there for us. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk with Brock about her new book, True Refuge. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Robert Spitzer, author of The Politics of Gun Control, chair of the Department of Political Science at the State University of New York in Cortland, New York. Also with us, Richard Feldman. He's the president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. And we have lots of calls waiting in the wings or waiting in line at 1-888-477-9499. Richard Feldman, I just want to pick up on what Robert said right before the break about essentially that the industry could do more. Perhaps we should think of some technological fixes for this problem of guns in this country.
You know, yes, and there's plenty of people working on it, but it sounds simple. And every time you get deep into this issue, and I've been very deep into it, every fix that makes the gun safer in one particular situation makes it more difficult and therefore less useful in another, and therein lies the problem. You can make a gun perfectly safe. Of course, it has no validity as a firearm. All guns are not meant to kill. Guns are meant and designed to fire a projectile at high speed downrange from where the barrel is pointed. The gun doesn't decide how to use itself. Only a person decides how that gun gets used. And in the hands of a law enforcement officer or a civilian protecting themselves or target shooting, there's nothing wrong. It works perfectly fine. And that very same gun in the hands of a criminal is a horrible instrumentality. So the focus is always in whose hands are the guns.
Richard Feldman, let me ask you a very practical question, and this is, there was some testimony before Congress about self-defense, frankly, women and self-defense. From your perspective, what would be the best firearm to use for self-defense, a shotgun or an AR-15?
All depends on the situation that the person's in. Are you inside a home? Are you outside? It really is very situational.
How about for you, Robert Spitzer? Have you thought about that?
Well, I think the notion that this woman who testified before Congress a couple of weeks ago talked about using an assault weapon with a large capacity magazine, which was perfectly absurd. I mean, handguns obviously are the preference of people who get guns, civilians who get guns for self-defense. A shotgun is more sensible. An AR-15, that's really pretty dumb by and large. You could do it, obviously, but if your objective with a large capacity magazine, if your objective is to kill maybe some of the neighbors and redecorate your house in an adverse way, that might be the way to go. But otherwise,
well, I'm gonna have to take some
go ahead, Richard.
To that.
Go ahead, Richard.
You know, an AR-15 that fires a 223 round with a high capacity magazine. Look, I do a lot of law enforcement training and instruction. And when you have a stationary target, it's very nice. I probably need a single-shot pistol, and I'm going to hit the bullseye. When you have three or four people break into your home, and they're running around, I want as much firepower as possible. I'm not likely to hit any of them on the first one or two or three rounds I fire. People are looking for cover. I mean, this isn't like television where the cops hit the good guys hit the bad guys on the first shot. I want as much firepower as I possibly can to protect myself in that situation. I'm not misusing the gun. It's the people who broke into my house that shouldn't be there in the first place.
Is that an argument then for an AR-15, are you saying, Richard?
Well, I prefer a 12-gauge shotgun with as many rounds as possible. But as Robert certainly knows, a shotgun is the only gun besides a machine gun that actually does spray fire. I can have 30 or more pellets coming out each time I fire that round. That's a lot of firepower, a whole lot more than from an AR-15.
Anything you want to add to that, Robert? I do want to get back to our callers.
Well, no, get to your callers.
Okay.
You've got only about 10 minutes.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much for getting us back to, it looks like, Bill from Villis, New Jersey. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, how you doing?
Hi.
I'm calling to speak about the gun control. I'm a retired law enforcement department of corrections, and lifetime member NRA. I got to agree that the pair's comments were a little bit harsh, and he doesn't represent really all the NRA members in the comments he made. I feel a lot of our laws just aren't being enforced as they are. We dedicate too many resources of law enforcement to other agencies and issues. But state of New Jersey, we have the firearms ID card, and I think all states should pretty much have that kind of a program. Mm. Not let the federal government get involved, where you just end up with more bureaucracy, and or just everything will be, you know, another group of people to handle this, another department to handle that. And we'll just get lost in all the politics of it.
Well, Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You raised several several different points, including this question about Robert Spitzer about enforcing the laws on the book. And I have to say, because we had the Philadelphia Police Commissioner in last week, and that was one of the things that he was very strong about, saying that we have to do a better job enforcing the laws that we already have.
Certainly the case. We know at the federal level, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is the agency that's charged with administering gun laws, has been hobbled by various reasons, including by pressure from the NRA to keep it from enforcing the existing laws effectively. Certainly, existing laws should be enforced. There is more that could be done in that realm, but that would not preclude looking at other legislative remedies to address the gun issue as well.
And to you, Richard, our caller raised an interesting point about the state's responsibility and the responsibilities of the federal government. How do you see those two things?
Well, there's certainly far more law enforcement resources in the various states than there is on the federal level. And I agree with Robert that we've done a very poor job in this country of giving the very agency tasked with enforcing the federal gun laws the resources necessary to accomplish their task. That's why 4 weeks ago I asked the Vice President to put back into the budget monies for the NIBIN program, the National Integrated Ballistic Information System, which this administration has taken out for the last 3 years. That allows law enforcement to be able to identify crime, ballistics, suspects, and guns. A week later, the White House got back to me. They agreed, and rather than just put $23 million, they've just put $50 million into the budget for the FY14 year. So that's momentum in the right direction. That's a part of this very complicated, multifaceted problem. We have to do everything right, and it's still not going to be perfect.
Thanks for that call. Robert Spitzer, I'm looking at something that you wrote recently. It's titled Five Myths About Gun Control. One of the myths being the Second Amendment was intended to protect the right of Americans to rise up against a tyrannical government. Demystify that myth for us.
Yeah, it is something that's often repeated, and people harken back to the revolutionary period where Americans rose up and overthrew the British. But what they fail often to note is that they were revolting against the British because the British were tyrannical, did not accept our representation. We weren't represented in that governing, in the governing by the British, but we were fighting on behalf of our own governmental system. And as soon as the revolution was over, we established our own government. And the way in which citizens can change what their government is doing is to express their approval or disapproval through elections, the ballot box, through the jury box, through petitioning the government for redress of grievances, and all of the peaceful means that we have for influencing our government. The idea that the Constitution somehow provides anywhere within it, either in the Second Amendment or any place else, the right of citizens to overthrow their government, which means, you know, kidnapping, killing, revolution, violence, destruction of property, and mayhem, is utterly against the Constitution, and in fact, the very militias that the Second Amendment refers to are to be used in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, to suppress rebellions and domestic insurrections, not to cause them.
Richard, anything you want to add to that?
Sure. Professor Spitzer is only partially correct. While the Constitution is viewed as our primary law, on equal level with the Constitution is our Declaration of Independence, which gives us the right to overthrow a tyrannical government. Now, I certainly agree with the professor that That doesn't even seem like a remote possibility at the moment. But I hark back and remember very well in my history, George Washington didn't protest the British coming to collect the guns and the ammunition in Lexington and Concord. He shot them. And frankly, the Declaration of Independence is still good law recognized by the Supreme Court of the United States of America.
Robert, go ahead.
I would just add, the Declaration is not a legally binding document. It was simply our justification for revolution. Provides no basis for citizens to rise up.
Let me be clear, though. I'm not suggesting for one second here. And many people have asked me over the years, representing the firearm industry or the NRA, when they get angry, I say, when we lose, it's our own fault on our side, and we have to do a much better job of articulating our position, educating people, doing what you're supposed to do in a democracy. You educate, you inform, you motivate, and you get your people to the polls on election day. Now, when they cancel the election, that's when everything changes. But I don't see that occurring.
Do you, Robert?
Well, no, I don't either, and I agree entirely with Mr. Feldman's last point.
And let me get, looks like Jay from Cherry Hill to join us. And Jay, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I have two questions. Should it be legal for me to buy ammunition for a gun I'm not the registered owner of? And should gun owners be required to have liability insurance covering the foreseeable damage caused by not safekeeping their weapons?
Two very good questions. Richard Feldman, what's your response?
Well, if we're going to require liability insurance, then we need to cover. Why pick on guns? If you're going to own knives in your home, maybe you need specific liability insurance. More people are knifed in this year than are shot anyway. More people die in this country every year from medical misadventures by doctors holding scalpels, an instrumentality whose only purpose is to cut human flesh. And in the hands of a trained surgeon, it can be a wonderful instrumentality of healing. But in the hands of a crazed person or a poor physician, it can cause untold damage. Instead of getting into all these extreme what-ifs, let's get back to focusing on the problem. 110 million of your fellow Americans are not misusing the guns they own today. When you talk about ammunition, you know, you don't have to just buy ammunition. There are at least 15, 20 million Americans that make their own ammunition. You can load your own ammunition. It's not very hard at all. So, you know, you got to understand the whole nature of what goes on out there to be able to craft solutions that have any chance of being successful and not seeming ridiculous to the very people you're trying to regulate, which are the people that don't care in the first place about the laws, not those who do.
Jay, thanks for the call. Robert Spitzer, anything you want to add to what Richard Feldman just said?
Yeah, a couple points. Doctors have malpractice insurance for the very reason he describes. Automobile owners are required to have insurance. Liability insurance to come along with gun ownership absolutely should be done. It would be a market-based solution, and it also encompasses not just the question of criminals or criminal activity, but those who are careless with their guns, who don't store them properly, who make them too easily accessible to people who are suicide-prone. There are 9,000 gun homicides every year, but 19,000 gun suicides every year. That needs more attention.
Let me get Sarah from Haddonfield to join us on Radio Time. Sarah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a quick question. Would you think it would be helpful or feasible to register each and every gun that is purchased and then have a renewal of the registration every 1 or 2 years to track the owners?
Does that make sense to you, Richard Feldman?
Nope.
Why not?
We'd have a huge bureaucracy. Who's going to pay attention to that bureaucracy? The people who are not misusing the guns. What criminal is going to go steal a gun and then demand to get it registered, to go through a background check? It's just another government feel-good program that will have no utility. And as the Canadians have learned the hard way, when they suggested it would be a couple of million dollars to register all the guns in Canada. They've now spent several billion dollars, and it hasn't achieved anything that it was intended to achieve in the first place. It sounds good for those who are ill-informed, misinformed, and uninformed, but once you understand the nature of this issue, 310 million firearms owned legally in this country today, it's not going to have any impact on the very problem that you and I would both want to fix.
And Robert Spitzer, about 45 seconds before we have to say goodbye. I wish we could go on because it's been a great conversation. But hearing some difference of opinion, but some consensus here, can we find, you think, some middle ground on this issue when we speak to members of Congress and even to the larger culture?
I think there is an opportunity now to find some real middle ground, partly because of people like Richard Feldman, who's addressing this issue from a gun rights perspective, but doing so in a sensible way, frankly, even though he and I might disagree on some particulars. The country wants change, and for technological and other reasons, there's a lot that can be done that hasn't been done. The irony is that guns are far less regulated than virtually any other consumer commodity that you can think of in society, and it's time to get on board, I think, and to modernize this for America for the 21st century.
Well, to be continued. Robert Spitzer, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Been a pleasure.
And he's a professor of political science, chair of the Department of Political Science at the State University of New York, wrote a book called The Politics of Gun Control. Richard Feldman, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's the president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.